Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Pranab Bardhan of the University of California, Berkeley. Pranab and I met at the London School of Economics in May 2010, where we spoke about his new book, Awakening Giants, Feet of Clay, Assessing the Economic Rise of China and India. And I began by asking him what he saw as the value of comparing these two enormous countries.
Well, these two countries being enormous, as you said, obviously attract attention when they start rising. And this is a historic phenomenon. If you go back to 1820, if you take the calculations of Angus Madison, who recently died, actually, 1820, half of the world income was accounted for by these two countries. Jump to 1950, 9%. It's a big decline. Projection is that 2025, the two together will be about 36%. So it's not be restored to half a world income, but then it'll be significant. In 200 years, this is a big change. And the rise has happened in the last 20, 25 years. So it's such a short period, such a big change, particularly in China, has attracted, obviously, a great deal of attention. Most of the interest I see in Western media and also some in academia, the interest is what this implies for the rest of the world. That is not the focus of my book. My book is trying to understand what has happened to these masses of people in these two giant countries and under what constraints they live. So in that sense, it's an obvious comparison. Both are ancient countries. Both are primarily agrarian countries until very, very recently. In terms of national income, they're not primarily agricultural countries anymore. In India, it's about 17% of GDP. In China, it's about 12%. But huge numbers of people are still dependent on agriculture. In India, it's more like half. In China, it's a little less than half, but still very large. So they're still agrarian countries in terms of livelihoods of people. And both are doing very well, particularly in terms of economic growth. But what I'm interested in is not just growth rates, because in the case of China, it's not just the growth, it's the composition of the growth has also attracted attention. It's become the so-called manufacturing workshop of the world. I slightly qualify that in the book, because when people think about manufacturing workshop, they're really thinking about output. For these countries, relatively poor countries, most of the manufacturing they do is processing, assembling. So an economist who is more interested in what's happening to value added, deducting the cost of components and materials. In those terms, China is not yet the value-added manufacturing center of the world, not yet. Numbers are that in 2009, China has about 15% of total world value-added in manufacturing, about the same as Japan, where the United States is about 25, Europe is about 20. So it's not yet the largest. It's probably going to go there some years, but that's just, in a sense, minor qualification. It is, no doubt, huge phenomenal increase in manufacturing. Corresponding thing that's also attracted a lot of attention in India is not manufacturing, is the service sector. Particularly you hear stories about software, business processing. So if China is called the manufacturing workshop, India has become the back office of the world and so on. People call me a contrarian because I also try to talk about qualifications. There is a qualification there in India. In fact, I would say a huge qualification for India. Some people in India think that India will be able to skip this stage. You go to service after you've done quite well in manufacturing. Most of the rest of the world, developed countries, that's how it happened. India seemed to be leapfrogging. But I think there are problems there, and you can see that if when you look at the numbers, you hear about these stories, software, information technology. So if you take all the people who are employed in the IT, information technology, or wherever information technology is IT-enabled services, including even the low-tech end of it, including call centers, say, So if you take all the possible numbers of people employed in this sector, as of today, what proportion of the total Indian labor force they employ? It's less than 0.5% or 1%. So with all the big stories, it's not going to transform India. Manufacturing is more likely to have transformed China, because manufacturing employs a lot of people. Particularly China has gone for, in the beginning, not no longer now, gone for labor-intensive manufacturing, like garments, like shoes, like toys, like wigs, and so on. Those are labor-intensive. They employ a lot of people. But Indian success stories are not in labor-intensive. So most of software is skill-intensive. So that's why it doesn't employ vast masses of people. It's highly skill-intensive. India's done reasonably well in pharmaceuticals industry. That's also research and skill-intensive. India has just about started doing well in some industries like car industry and car parts and some machine tool industry. But all of these are relatively capital-intensive and skill-intensive. So in that sense, the transformation people are in used to be in agriculture really to give them good jobs, that has not happened for the majority of people.
I'd like to come on to directly that issue, actually, the impact of the growth of these two countries on the lives of the great mass of the population. I mean, we hear about the burgeoning middle class, so many people taken out of poverty. What is the reality about the impact of growth on poverty and inequality in these two countries?
The reality is very, very impressive in the case of China. It's an unparalleled achievement in history. Of course, there are always controversies about poverty numbers, but I think the basic truth will be there, whichever numbers, poverty lines you use, etc. So let me take a crude one, but it's easily available, which is the World Bank number. And let me take $1 a day as the poverty line in 2005 prices. So if you compare China between 1981 and 2005, which is the latest data that the World Bank will give you, so in 24 years, about 625 million people have been raised above this $1 line, poverty line. Never before in history this has happened. Within 24 years, less than quarter century. Nothing comparable has happened in India. India, there has been a significant decline in the percentage of people who are below that line. So from about 44% in the 1981, it's come to around 24%, something like that. But the population is growing, so if you look at the absolute numbers, there's not that big a change. And so it's still about 250 million people are below the poverty line. Of course, China, even when it's now 2005, it's only 8%. 8% of 1.3 billion is a large number, so it's still about 100 million people below the poverty line. But the raising 625 million is really unparalleled. So it is very impressive for China. India is significant, but not that dramatic. One important purpose of this book is to clarify and sometimes dispel some of the myths that have accumulated. And I can give you an example of this from in answering your question. So this big poverty decline, in much of the financial press, you will often see this is because of the global integration of China into the world economy. So globalization, trade, foreign investment, these have been so. I mean, all these years they have been insulated, and now in global integration did this historic decline. I don't believe in that. It's not entirely untrue, but much of it is not true. And I'll give you the numbers. So I told you about the 625 million people have been raised above the World Bank poverty line within 24 years. But now, in my book, I cite the yearly changes in this period. So if you look at the cities, more than half of this was done by 1987. China's big global integration is late in the 90s. And in a big way, since China became a member of WTO, the World Trade Organization, 2001. But by 87, more than half of the 624 million been raised. So what's going on in the 80s? What was going on in the 80s? Big change in agriculture in China. And that's why in these two large countries, these are mainly agrarian countries, and the poor are concentrated in the agricultural sector. So what happens to agriculture really decides the destiny for quite some time, maybe not 50 years from now, but even now. So China, big change happened in agriculture in the early 80s. One is they decollectivized. So they gave households the right to use land as they want, subject to some limits. But it also is associated with what I would call one of history's most egalitarian land reforms. So they did not give people ownership rights on land, use rights, but the use rights were completely equitably distributed. So if you live in a village, you will get the same amount of land as your neighbor. Only qualification is if you have a larger family to start with, you'll get a little bit more land. So it is by demographic. And of course, it depends on the regional average. So you get the average of the whole region. Subject to this rhythm, rather two minor things, it's really one of history's most egalitarian land distribution. What does it do on the question of poverty, the question that you asked me? It provides a floor to your income. You know, your income is not going to fall below suddenly because everybody has land. That is not true in India. India, vast masses of people are still landless. Landless or almost landless. If you take landless or almost landless, that 40% of the rural households. There is no floor for these people. That is the big difference. So the dramatic change, I think, in China is because of this land reform. They also did other things to agriculture. They suddenly raised the price at which they were procuring grains from the farmers, etc. That played a role, no doubt. The major change, I think, is in agriculture, but I'm not going to suggest that globalization did not play any role. It did play any role later, because, as I already mentioned, Chinese started producing labor-intensive industries, and those are the products they could sell cheaply in the world. So trade and foreign investment in those places, in those industries played a role. So I'm not denying that, but I don't think that is the major change is really starting much earlier. So it's domestic factors rather than globalization which played a very important role. India also. India has not globalized to the same extent as China did. India's opening up of the economy to the rest of the world, to the global economy, started only in the middle 93-94, around that time. So if you again look at the poverty figures in India, not dramatic decline, it's been declining almost steadily. You don't see that the rate of decline suddenly picked up when India became more globalized since 93. It's about almost the same rate. I read about this in the Economist magazine, Financial Times, which I read very diligently every week. But it's through constant repetition, this has become conventional wisdom. And this is one of the things I'm challenging.
The title of your book is Awakening Giants, Feet of Clay. What do you mean by the feet of clay?
Oh, several things and different types of things in the two countries. India, feet of clay is easier to write about. There are lots of things there, and they haven't done as well as China. Poverty, I just told you, that has not, they have not done that well. Growth rates is lower. Manufacturing, where the jobs are, they have not done that well compared to China. Something, again, is contrary to popular impression. A lot of people think that Chinese inequality is more than India's. That's not the case. Look at numbers, but they don't know they're really comparing apples and oranges. The Chinese numbers of inequality are in income inequality. The India does not collect income data. Indian inequality is consumer expenditure. And in all countries, almost all countries, consumer expenditure distribution is less unequal because the rich people save, but it's not captured in the consumer. So the usual figures, they really don't compare. India does not collect income data usually, but there are 1 to 2 years some institutions have collected income data, and if you use those, inequality is much higher in India. In general, inequality is higher in India partly because of something that I've already mentioned and partly about something else, which is a lot of people don't have any floor. I mean, the landless people or near landless people. So at the bottom, there are a lot of people. And the same thing is true in education. And if you did not have land, one way you could escape is through education. India still a very large number of people illiterate. Even in the young, say, if I remember right, 16 to 24 age group, the little boy above 20% are illiterate. And the other thing about India, before I talk about China, is that Chinese have really, in the book there's a chapter called Dazzling Difference. The dazzling difference is in infrastructure. What I mean by infrastructure, I mean roads, highways and ports and airports and electricity, etc., railways. In all this, India is lagging. The feet of clay for China would be several. One, of course, has to do with environment. Partly because China has industrialized much more than India, the environmental, certainly in some indicators of environment like pollution, etc., China is much worse. India, of course, is not that much better in some other aspects of environment. If you look at, say, sanitation, drinking water and sanitation, some people would say India is worse in terms of the pollution. But pollution due to fossil fuel combustion is much worse in China. Financial sector is healthier in India than in China. Corporate governance is much less transparent in China. And to this day, the state really controls the economy and the state controls the banks, much more than in India. India also, the state is very important in the banks. They control the banks, so there is a lot of this, you might say, crony capitalist lending. And, for example, in the recent crisis, the government just ordered the banks to give out huge loans. So there is a loan spree that went on. Very soon it will show up in the form of non-performing loans, bad loans. And this has fed the property bubble. China is now sitting on a huge property bubble. This is a big problem for them. India also has some of this state control of banks, therefore some misallocation, etc., but nowhere near China's. The other feature of clay has to do with politics, political economy rather. And one of the points that I make here, and in fact, I have a whole chapter which is essentially talking about democracy and development, etc., and obviously China is an authoritarian country. But Indians shouldn't take too much satisfaction out of it, because even though India is a democratic country, there are lots of what I call accountability failures, in the sense of accountability to the poor people. So poor people are not just below the larger numbers in poverty line, education, health, nutrition, horrendous situation in India. So in a sense, the local leaders are not that accountable to the people. There are serious accountability failures. In China, obviously it's an authoritarian country, so as a result, what happens is that the Chinese try to control too much, and they control very heavy-handedly. And sometimes this means, in fact this sounds like a paradoxical statement, is that it looks like Chinese government is a stronger government, takes decisive action, quick decisions. India is a slow democratic process. Any controversial issue, they will go on arguing and discussing and street demonstrations and maybe even property damage and police firing and all that. So it looks like kind of messy. But India's strength is in the messiness. So a given fall in economic performance is not that regime threatening. Chinese regime, derives its legitimacy from high economic growth and the nationalist glory that derives from it. So they get very scared if their growth rate tries to fall. India, a large decline in growth rate doesn't do anything to the regime, because the regime derives its legitimacy elsewhere, and that legitimacy is in from the democratic pluralism. So China, whenever there is some disturbance, some conflict, like a ton of bricks, they try to come crashing down on it and therefore generate more conflicts and more unrest. India has a lot more conflicts than China, because India is a much more heterogeneous society in terms of religion, in terms of caste, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of language. It's one of the world's most heterogeneous societies. Still, there are some conflicts India has not been able to resolve, but by and large, compared to China, compared to what China faces in Tibet and with the Uyghurs, which are minor compared to what India faces, India manages conflicts. So one of the things I say, democracy allows you to manage conflicts better. And when you cannot manage conflicts well, there is a tendency to go off the rails. So in that sense, instability, potential instability of the Chinese government is much more. Going off the rails is much more likely to happen, and therefore the ensuing political stability and then economic instability.
Can we learn from these two countries about this fundamental relationship between politics and economics in terms of, you know, advice you would give to other countries about what political framework you would ideally have to encourage rapid growth? Because we've seen it in both countries, and as you say, you know, one's a democracy and one's a very authoritarian.
Well, it depends on what you mean by growth. To me, growth per se doesn't mean much, particularly in poor countries. Is there growth of income on the bottom half of the population? And there, I think India has not done that well. Even in the high growth rates now, it's not really gone down to that level. And the other is delivery of social services. I already said India has dismal performance in education, health, and nutrition. And so the advice is really strengthening the mechanisms of accountability. Democracy at the parliament level is not enough. India has democracy at the parliament level, at the provincial level, and so on. But local level democracy is still weak, so there is accountability failure. Corresponding problem in China is that while the Chinese have done much better in the education service and poverty removal, but let me give you an example of accountability failure to the local level. What it does is that the Chinese local party officials, they in cahoots with commercial developers, mining interests, they pollute the environment, they grab land much more arbitrarily. There are some problems in India also in land acquisition, but nowhere near. Some estimate that I've seen as of 2007, China has already displaced about nearly 66 million people. So, and they do it heavy-handedly, and so this is a tremendous amount of unrest. It's because there's no accountability. In India, there are at least some forum where you can protest about this land acquisition and so on. So in terms of advice, strengthened accountability mechanisms at the local level, that would be the major thing. And of course, from that follows many other mechanisms of doing things. However, although I mentioned about that much, some of the poverty decline is not in either country is due to domestic factors, not globalization, I'm not anti-globalization. I think the good thing about globalization, which certainly has helped China a great deal and to some extent India, is in terms of two things particularly. One is it helps technological upgrading, and the other is it disciplines. You know, you tend to become flabby when there's no competition. The global competition reduces the flab of the economy. So in that sense, no doubt that globalization plays an important role, and this is a problem with the Indian left, for example. They're very much, quite often, anti-globalization. And I think this is, you know, this is going to harm the economies. This is going to shut out from the rest of the world.
Well, that comes on to the final question I wanted to ask you, Pranav, which is really, serious economists are always wary of making forecasts, but you've done a very detailed study of these two countries. Where would you project forward for the two of them comparatively? Or another way of asking you, you cite in your book being asked many years ago which country you would prefer to live in, all else being equal. What is your prognosis of the future prospects for these two countries?
I start by saying that, in fact, I quote a Malaya-born poet saying that I now know too much to feel at home anywhere. to your last question. But going back to the future, I always also very wary of giving any... This might be my famous last words when you... But the big thing people point out increasingly is the demographic issue. China, because of the one-child policy, the growth rate of the population has been lower. So very soon the Chinese population will start aging. Looking at the future, aging sooner, much sooner than India. Let me give you a number. They draw curves for the number of workers per dependent, okay? So the peak and then it falls, as has happened already in Western countries. China, the peak will be reached in 3 years, 2013, around. It might be give or take. Corresponding peak in India will be 2035. So there is a window, demographic window of opportunity for India. If things go well, then this will narrow the growth rate difference between China and India, and some optimists in India see things, India's will even exceed China's. But I have, again, as usual, I have some qualifications. One qualification is that why is it that younger population helped growth? Two reasons main. One is that younger populations are productive, old people are not that productive, so that improves productivity. Second is the younger people save, older people dissave. So saving also, so both of these reasons raises growth rate. Saving angle probably might work in India. In fact, already household saving rate is higher in India than China. Although the total saving rate is higher in China because much of the other saving, non-household saving, is in China, is government saving and the state companies saving. But it's the productivity. So this assumes the higher productivity because of younger workers and higher saving. Assume these younger people have good jobs. Unfortunately, the higher rate of growth of population in India is in areas which are not growing very fast. It's in these large, populous, backward areas. They're backward not merely in terms of economic growth, they're also backward in terms of fertility control. The higher growth areas, fertility control is much more active. So unless these large numbers of people move and go to the high growth areas, which to some extent is happening, but it cannot happen in a big way, so there is a good chance that India may not be able to give these young people in that many good jobs. And to that extent, I'd say, qualify the demographic difference, the narrowing of the growth rate that people talk about. The other is education being better in China than in India. The quantity of productive people may go down, but quality will improve because of the larger spread of education. So in this respect, I would kind of qualify this optimism in India that the growth rate is good. But demographic is only one aspect. The future growth rates also depend on how technology improves, because that's the ultimate driver. And in that respect, both countries spend more money on research and development, etc., but China is doing much more. And in fact, in science and technology education, China is doing much better than India. One indicator is, if you look at citation index in science journals, China used to be lower than India. I'm talking about not Chinese or Indians abroad, I'm talking about residents. The Chinese curve has shot up, which probably tells you that in terms of research and development, Chinese development of technology may be faster. So if you are interested in growth rate, over time probably they will grow at similar rate. You know, China, some reasons for decelerating, some reasons for doing better than India. But if they can maintain this growth rate, it's good enough. But it will also depend on income inequality. Well, I said China's income inequality is somewhat better than India's. There's no question that its income is going up. So what will happen to the bottom half of the population, even if the growth rate remains high, will depend on what is happening to inequality. So China as well as India, both countries' inequality is going up. That is a problem that both countries have to resolve. They haven't successfully done so far.
All right, well done. Thank you very much.